Okay, welcome everybody. Welcome to our second session of Mind Sciences, and we have a great lineup again. Our first speaker is Dr. Peter Payne. He's a philosopher at the Institute for Credible Christianity, and he's going to be talking about personhood and Thomas Nagel.
Okay, I actually gave a talk on what is a person at the Evangelical Philosophical Society meetings last November. And I'm going to start off by a thing I did for them, and then I'm going to shift over and talking more about Thomas Nagel. But I think it's important to sort of set the issue in context, and that it really is an important issue. And I think the question, what is a person, is a great segue of being able to help people who are convinced that the physical world all exists, that they might be wrong. And help them open up to the possibilities. We're talking about what is a person. Person can be used, a physical person, capacity 45 persons. But here we're talking about person, the inner person, the subjective self, the experience that I have, that sense of person, both the center of feelings and the agent of actions. In the talk I gave last November, I talked about five common beliefs that even many atheists hold to. But none of these beliefs actually make sense within a science, from the standpoint of science. They're all problematic from the standpoint of science, but they're all quite crucial to our own sense of personal identity. So our identity and sense of worth is who we are is tied up with our sense of ourselves as persons. So it's not the case that anyone can say, well, I'll just stop believing in my own personhood, and no problem. No. Actually, my sense of worth is who I am as a person. It's kind of like I had a new philosophy grad student who was a Buddhist who said the person doesn't exist. Well, that means that the person who is finishing the PhD is not the same one who started. You know, why are you working for that person and doing all this for someone else that's not you? So the person's a doer over time. Are you the same person that you were when you're 5 years old? From a physical standpoint, there's very little matter the same. I don't know how Nancy Murphy answers that question. Persons have conscious experiences. We'll talk about quite a bit about that with Thomas Nagel. Persons are causal agents, not just persons' bodies, but myself as a subject. Do I actually have any influence at all on the future course of my behavior? Or is my conscious thought simply carried along by my brain? The fact that I have conscious thoughts, do those things actually influence my life at all? And from a physical standpoint, there's good reason to think, no, that's not the case. I'm just simply carried along. That's the free will determinism kind of question. Do I bear responsibility? If I couldn't do other than what I do, there's good reason to say, no, you don't bear responsibility. Persons are of great and roughly equal worth. All these things are things which are fundamental to who we think of ourselves. And a person rejects all these and says, my worldview can't include any of them. That's a serious problem. And ought to motivate a person to look for something other than physicalism if, in fact, they don't like what they find there. Francis Crick summarizes it here. He says, you, the person, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity, and free will are, in fact, no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Who you are is nothing but a pack of neurons. All right? From a scientific standpoint, he's got a good case there. Though he's saying it rather bluntly. Okay, Thomas Nagel, in 2012, came out with a book titled Mind and Cosmos. But the subtitle was the real grabber. The subtitle is Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. Now, almost all the atheists I know are convinced that the naturalism, materialism, is almost certainly true. In fact, that's a major reason why they dismiss anything religious, because after all, we know that there's nothing beyond physics. There's nothing supernatural, there's nothing non-material, the physical world, all that's real is simply that. And here's a prominent atheist, Thomas Nagel's an atheist, an eminent philosopher, coming out of the book saying that the materialism and the neo-Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. I need to insert here that he's not at all anti-evolution. The neo-Darwinian project is to give a purely physical explanation of evolution. But if you can't give a purely physical explanation of mind, then clearly if mind is the product of evolution, then you can't give an purely physicalistic explanation of mind through evolution. So he's not anti-evolution, he's not anti-physics, he's simply that they're incomplete, they don't account for mind as we know it. A very important earlier article. I encourage you to look it up online sometime. It has been republished, re-edited, included in anthologies all over the place, called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? And it's not the baseball bat, but the animal bat. This is a weekly standard. I found this on Sean Carroll's blog. Sean Carroll is a physicist at Caltech. And the person being burned at the stake there is Thomas Nagel. And the people around him in this article are people who came to a workshop just about a month or so after his book came out. And the workshop was entitled Moving Naturalism Forward. It had a very interesting collection of these luminary atheists who were there. It included Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Steven Weinberg, Sean Carroll, and a variety of other people. So it was really this sort of highlighted list of famous atheists came together, and they just railed against Thomas Nagel and his book. And there was an article that came out by Andrew Ferguson with the site there talking about what they said within that. Sean Carroll, the physicist I mentioned who was there, says the reason for all the fuss is, of course, that the materialist Darwinist conception of nature is almost certainly true. So it's worth pushing back against the respected philosopher who says otherwise. So here's the physicist who says, no, naturalism is almost certainly true, and we need to push back against Thomas Nagel for having the audacity as an atheist to say something as foolish and as out of court as what he's saying. Interesting enough, in his article, he talks about Thomas Nagel putting too much emphasis on intelligibility. We have to have somehow conscious experience, they have to be intelligible to us, we have to understand how they fit. And he says, no, there can be things which aren't intelligible to us, that shouldn't be a driving force for us. But he makes the following comment: either matter obeys the laws of physics, or physics is wrong. And then Nagel advocates overthrowing things that are precisely defined, extremely robust, and impressively well-tested, the known laws of physics, natural selection, on the basis of ideas that are rather vague, and Nagel's ideas are quite vague, and he grants they're vague, and much less well-supported, a conviction that consciousness can't be explained physically, a demand for intelligibility and moral realism. In The Mind and Cosmos, Nagel argues for more realism, that there is objective moral right and wrong, and that you can trust your fundamental intuitions about that. What's interesting to me is he's accusing Thomas Nagel of overthrowing science, overthrowing physical laws. He's no more overthrowing physical laws than the person who entertains the possibility that God could do miracles within this world. The physical laws are still there. It's just that one has another thing than one's to take into account. So it's not the case that everything happens in the physical realm is going to exactly follow physical laws. But it's not as though if you buy into Thomas Nagel's suggestion that you're throwing out physical laws, you're throwing out science. So he's really attacking a straw man by saying that Thomas Nagel's overthrowing all of science. Thomas Nagel says, no, science is perfectly good at what it does, but it doesn't cover everything. Okay, what is it like to be a bat? Actually, in this article, he does much more of a critique of naturalism than he does in Mind and Cosmos. In Mind and Cosmos, he's asking if, in fact, you cannot reduce mental events down to physical events, what are the consequences of that? What are the consequences about how we think about the world? And then he engages in a project of saying, well, how can we begin to think about that? So he's engaging in a project of metaphysics. What kind of metaphysics can we come up with that could replace naturalism? And he's not saying he's come up with it, but he's saying there's a need for a new metaphysics, and here's some things that I think need to go into it. And what is it like to be a bat? He says, the fact that an organism has conscious experience at all means basically there is something it is like to be that organism. So that's what I'm talking about. If it has conscious experience, it's something like it to be that organism. I assume we all believe that bats have experience. There is something it is like to be a bat. And most people would say when a bat's flying around a pitch black cave, it's not sort of without experience. It experiences the cave in a similar way we wish to experience this room visually, but they do it through echolocation, which is a sensory mode we don't have. So we ask, what is it like for to be a bat? We don't know, because we don't have that kind of sensory reception. We could give analogs and say, well, it's a little bit like visual experience than a spatial, but we really can't know what it's like for the bat to be a bat. But the presumption is it's not an automaton, but it actually experiences the cave and is having experience. What is that like? What is it like to be a bat? If one knew all the facts of physics about a bat, would one know what it's like to be a bat? And Nagel's conclusion, as well as many people who read the article, say no. Even if you knew exactly how the sound waves get transmitted to the brain, how the information gets processed, how it enables the bat to not fly into other bats, how it manages to maneuver and everything, even if you knew exactly everything that's going on in the bat's physiology and brain, would you know what it's like to be a bat? He says, no, you wouldn't. That was something you only know if you had the perspective of a bat, you got some of the physiology of a bat. We can understand what feelings are like for other people, but not for a bat, because we don't have echolocation. So therefore, we wouldn't know what it's like to be a bat. But the implication of this is that no physical analysis of the bat's brain, nor of the functional analysis of the input brain behavior, will include the fact of what it's like to be a bat. So psychophysical reduction will invariably fail. And for the last 40, 50 years, most atheist philosophers working on this have been trying to say, okay, here, we need to analyze cognitive experiences, we need to analyze conscious experiences in terms of physical properties. Because after all, it can't be dangling out there as being some non-physical fact. If everything is physical, the things that don't seem physical actually are physical, and we simply have an analysis of it that shows that it's just physical. So that effort's been done over and over again, but if Nagel's right, then no matter what kind of analysis you would give of the functional relationship or what sort of brain states are in the bat, you would not know what it's like to be a bat. So there are facts that are not physical facts. Uh-oh. Physicalism seems to be in trouble. By the way, there's still people who argue that no, you would know, you could know what it's like to be a bat. You would know if you knew everything about their physiology, about their how their brain worked. The problem, Nagel says, is not confined to exotic case, however, for it exists between one person and another. I can know a lot about what it's like to be you, but I can't know exactly what it's like to be you because I'm not you and your perceptions are a little bit different than mine. So it means that we cannot accurately, completely know what other people are experiencing, even though we have things that are similar because we have similar brains. It doesn't work out exactly. So there's a problem even just between people of knowing what it's like to be another person. Implication: if mental processes are indeed physical processes, then there is something that is like intrinsically to undergo certain physical processes. What it is for such a thing to be the case remains a mystery. In his article, What It's Like to Be a Bat, he doesn't say materialism is wrong. He says, well, if it's right, then there has to be something intrinsic about a physical process which includes what it's like to be that physical process. But he says, we have no clue whatsoever as to what it could be like to be a physical process. So materialism might be right, but if it is, it's utterly mysterious. We have no way of being able to comprehend how it could be right. When he gets to mind cosmos, he no longer says it might be right, we just don't comprehend it. He says it's obvious, it's almost obviously false. Okay, down to talking about mind and cosmos. From the core of mind and cosmos, if you got the sheet, I have a sheet that has a summary of his book that he came out about a year afterwards. You can look it up online, but I printed it out here. He says, the physical sciences can describe organisms like ourselves as part of the objective spatial-temporal order, our structure and behavior in space-time, but they cannot describe the subjective experiences of such organisms or how the world appears to their different particular points of view. There could be a purely physical description of the neurophysiological processes that give rise to an experience and also of the physical behavior that is typically associated with it. But such a description, however complete, will leave out the subjective essence of the experience, how it is from the point of view of the subject, without which it would not be a conscious experience at all. So he says, when people are trying to show that experience is just physical, when they analyze experience but leave the subjective experience out of it, they haven't shown anything. They've left out the part that needs to be explained, and dealing with easier cases than trying to extend it to consciousness simply doesn't work. At least that's Nagel's case. Regarding the broader cognitive life of the mind, Nagel says, I believe that the role of consciousness in the survival of organisms is inseparable from intentionality, inseparable from perception, belief, desire, and action, and finally reason. So it's not just an issue about mind and body and what you do with consciousness, but he thinks consciousness is fundamental for our life of the mind, reasoning, beliefs, all that, says if you didn't have conscious states, none of the rest of this could work. So they're tied in together, which means that the mind itself can no longer be analyzed down to the physical, the rationality, etc. So intentionality, thought, and action resist psychophysical reduction and can exist only in the lives of beings that are also capable of consciousness. Nagel's goal, that's not something he's actually giving a specific answer to it, but his goal is to give a monistic metaphysics of the natural order that account both for the physical and the mental and how it could arise. By monistic, he said, let's no longer think just mental and material. We want to think of something which actually combines the two of them. So it's not a dualism of mind and matter, but we want to think of a metaphysics, the nature of reality that actually has both characteristics. And that's the aim that he's working towards. So we should seek a form of understanding that enables us to see ourselves and other conscious organisms as specific expressions simultaneously of the physical and mental character of the universe. He says the universe, for it to give rise to conscious beings, there has to be something about the nature of the physical universe, the nature of the natural order, which predisposes it such that you can get conscious beings arising at some time. So even before there are any conscious beings whatsoever, there has to be something in the universe, some mental aspect to it or something like that, that pushes it towards the emergence of conscious beings. It says, philosophy cannot generate such explanations. It can only point out the gaping lack of the present solutions and the obstacles to constructing them out of presently available material. So he's not saying, here's my philosophical explanation. He's saying there must be an answer and it has to lie in this direction. It's going to be up to others to try to discover it. Philosophers by themselves can't come up with the answer to the question. The one thing he does say is he thinks there must be some sort of natural teleology. There must be something in nature that predisposes and directs it towards the emergence of life and conscious life. When I think about natural theology, I think I do this quickly. There are naturalists who say there really are conscious states and they're not reducible down to physics. So John Searle, University of Berkeley, retired, I think he's still living, in 1992 came out with a book called Rediscovery of the Mind, and he said that his contention was that conscious mental states are not reducible to physical states, but that all that exists is physical. Conscious mental states are emergent properties of complex physical systems. So he's still a materialist, there's nothing but matter there, but out of complex material systems you get this feeling of consciousness. So it's an emergent property that can't be reduced down to it, but there's nothing but physics itself. The problem I have, one problem is all other high-level properties of physical systems seem explicable in terms of the nature of the parts and their interactions, such as, say, DNA encoding. But a second problem is how can an emergent property of a physical system have any causal effect on the system? Now, what I mean by that is all causal power would seem to lie in the physical constituents and their arrangement. After all causality has to be through mass and energy. It can't be through just some property that emerges from it. The causal power has to be in the physical substance itself. But the presumed universality of conscious states, sentience, and all higher phylum animals suggests the experience itself, must have survival value. So if it were just a happenstance that you have conscious states that arise in particular complex systems but doesn't do anything, well, why is it the case that all the higher organisms would have it? Surely there's some survival value in it, but if there's survival value in it, it must have causal effect. Donald Davison, by the way, says beliefs and experiences do have causal effect, but his conclusion, therefore, those beliefs must be material. Without trying to give any account for it, the fact that he thinks they have a causal effect means they must be material. Nagel's natural theology is not personal in character and has no intention. So it's not a pantheism. There's no being behind it. It's just somehow things pushing this direction. I find that utterly unintelligible. How can anything be pushing towards a goal if it has no awareness of the goal? There's no intentionality to it whatsoever. And it seems to me that theism makes much better sense if you say there has to be something beyond the material, and there has to be something, the mental, that explains why conscious beings are here. To say there's actually a mind behind it makes much more sense than to say there's simply this natural teleology. Let me add with a quote. This is from a review that came out in Prospect, a UK journal. Nagel's arguments against naturalism as an account of reality are powerful and demand close consideration.
even if his positive arguments for a natural theology end up looking every bit as intuitively implausible as a description of reality, which I think is the case, that leaves out consciousness. Questions?
Questions?
Yes. You go to the previous slide. At the top, he contradicted that two or three slides before when he was talking about consciousness.
Consciousness has Abel Seagull's, but he's saying there has to be something about the physical world itself that gives rise to it, that gives rise to the first, the life itself to begin with, and gives rise to structures of life which actually are sentient beings. So there has to be something apart from conscious beings itself, and he thinks there's nothing personal, there's no spirits within the world like that, or pantheism with which there's a personal intentions. It's something which is non, it doesn't have intentions, it's not personal, he wants to stay away from God completely, or anything has personal spirits to it. Okay, other question? Somebody back here, yes?
So I'm curious how you as a philosopher would respond to some people in the anti-neo-Darwinism camp, like Nagel, who take consciousness and apply it to molecules and or subatomic particles. DNA itself has consciousness, so say some scientists.
Actually, at one point, he says that it's proto-mind. And he says, what we mean by proto-mind, he says, I cannot give any content to that other than that which gives rise to mind. So panpsychism, in some ways, is true of him that makes you think that actually in atoms, a hydrogen atom has some sort of cyclical mental element to it. But there's no intelligible sense of our saying it's mental when we say it's mental. So what is proto-mental is sort of a placeholder at this point. So is he would grant that, no, it's not like minds as we know it, but it has to be something which gives rise to it. So he's really not committing himself to a whole lot. It's not so strange view of panpsychism, but to think there's something proto-mind that's actually directing things towards the emergence of life as we know it, conscious life, but without any intentions whatsoever, I find that to be utterly implausible, and theism being much more plausible. Someone else back here, yes?
You said earlier that to understand consciousness demands a kind of exactitude, and that I can't exactly know your subjective experience, so I can't know that you're conscious or know about consciousness in that way.
Now he says you can know if you're structured the same. So my experience would be similar to your experiences, but the extent to which we're structured differently, and my brain works differently than your brain. The extreme example would be that, an echolocation. But nonetheless, you get much more smaller things where I can understand a lot of what you're like. I'm justified in assuming that you're having experiences like what I'm having because we're both human beings. Mm-hmm. But when you start getting down the details, the exact character of it, there's going to be a subjective element which can't totally be eliminated even between people.
But how does that subjectivity negate the idea of consciousness or that as an explanation of consciousness?
It doesn't negate consciousness. He's saying that consciousness is irreducible down to physical explanation. And you can, if you can actually sort of become a bat and have a sort of a bat's brain implanted into your brain, then perhaps you could know what a bat would be like, right? But you can't do that. So there's the only way to have a bat is to have the bat's perspective, and that's something you cannot get from an external perspective, which this science of trying to understand how the bat works in physical terms is doing. Lauren?
So you said something about... if there's a survival effect, it must have causal powers.
Yeah.
What about life? What about vitalism? There seems to be an argument here that atoms, being what our usual metaphysics of atoms, can't produce conscious experience. Well, you could also say, well, atoms, being our metaphysics of atoms, can't produce living organisms. So I guess the bigger question is, why isn't this entire argument also an argument for vitalism?
Yeah, there's no strong argument for vitalism that says vitalism is real. In fact, it just doesn't do anything. Whereas when it comes to consciousness,
this is a very strong argument for vitalism. I don't believe vitalism.
Well, if it's vitalism, and somehow you say, well, vitalism, say, it's an emergent property. So you could have someone like John Searle say vitalism is an emergent property, and you're not going to find it in physics, but it's there. But if it's an emergent property, why is it an emergent property? And the fact that it's an emergent property, it doesn't seem as though being an emergent property, that's going to do any causal role. The causal role will all be with the neural structures that underlie the vitalist organism. All the causal power is there, so therefore, even if you have vitalism, it doesn't do anything causally, and hence, why should it be present so often if, in fact, it's present in all living things?
Right. So why isn't that also? Why isn't that statement also true of consciousness? I mean, what's different about a parallel argument between vitalism and consciousness following all these same?
Yeah, it's that we have a strong conviction that there actually is some experience it's like to be a bat. And then when I feel pain, I have a strong conviction that's not just pain behavior, but there's a feeling that I have with it. And even though I can't pinpoint it, a person says, well, what about vitalism? Vitalism is not the same thing where I can say, oh, well, I just feel that I have this vitalist spirit within me. Maybe some people would say that. But it seems to me that the direct awareness that we have of ourselves as conscious beings is what makes that something you can't simply set aside like you can't vitalism. Okay, yes, back here.
Last question.
I'm just throwing this out as my own idea. I feel that that bat is conscious because it's got memory and it can place itself in time and space. I have consciousness because I can think about my thinking in addition to being able to place myself in time and space.
Yeah, and the reductionists would say that consciousness is simply these functional capacities of being able to place myself in certain situations, being able to do this or do that, or be able to act on memories. The question is, does that actually account for the subjective experience itself? Does it simply make it vanish, or does it analyze it away? And if you're convinced that, no, the feeling of pain isn't just simply the functional relationships that I have to the world and the way in which my brain relates to functional behavior, then you're going to say there's something missing. But there are people who would say that, no, once you have the functional behavior, you do have the feeling. But I think many of us would say, no, that's not all. Okay.
Thank you very much again.